listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Los Angeles, 3,000 miles from the traditional hub of publishing. What has it meant in the past? What does it mean now? What are the advantages? How does one's lineage, both familial and literary, figure into one's view of oneself as a Los Angeles writer? These are just some of the questions we'll look at in tonight's panel, From the Outside Looking In, Writers Finding Their Place in Los Angeles. The moderator for tonight's panel is my esteemed colleague, David L. Ulan, a book critic for the Los Angeles Times. David is the author most recently of The Lost Art of Reading, Why Books Matter in a Distracted Time, and oh, is it distracted, we are so distracted. He's currently teaching in the USC Masters of Professional Writing program. He's also my partner in crime in curating this little mini-series within Aloud for Pacific Standard Time, which I'm sure most of you know is a Getty initiative, involves many, many institutions, and looks at art in Los Angeles from 1945 to 1980. We will bleed over those borders, but we are part of that conversation. This series has included an evening with Joan Didion at the historic Viviana Cathedral, a conversation with Lawrence Weschler, and a forthcoming event with poets Wanda Coleman and Lewis McAdams on April 12th, titled Concrete Rivers, The Emotional Topography of Los Angeles, moderated by the great Lynell George right here. So our panel tonight is made up of a stellar group of writers. All but one, you'll have to guess which one, was born here in Los Angeles. They write in a variety of forms, and they put their work out into the world in various ways. Our format tonight is going to include brief presentations of their work, a panel discussion, and then we'll open to questions from you. We will circulate microphones as we do record for podcast, so wait until they come for you. And now I'm going to make some very brief introductions, and then we will get going. Bernard Cooper is the author of Maps to Anywhere, A Year of Rhymes, Truth Serum, a collection of stories, Guess Again, and his most recent book, The Bill from My Father. He's the recipient of many awards, including the O. Henry Prize. His work appears in many anthologies and magazines, including Harper's, the New York Times Magazine. He teaches creative nonfiction at Bennington College, and he has a wonderful dog with pointed ears named Alice, which is, I mean, Gail Collins always mentions Mitt Romney's dog. This is so different because Alice is fantastic. Joyce Farmer, who is down there next to David, is best known for co-creating the Tits and Clits, Tits and Clits comics anthology in the 1970s, a feminist response to the rampant misogyny in underground comics. Her most recent work is a graphic memoir, Special Exits. Lynell George, who is right here to Bernard's left, is an award-winning journalist who, for more than 20 years, has covered Los Angeles and its environs as a staff writer for both the Los Angeles Times and the LA Weekly. She has studied Los Angeles through many prisms. She's the author of No Crystal Stair, African Americans in the City of Angels, a collection of reportage and essays drawn from her reporting, and she currently teaches journalism at Loyola Marymount University. Maricela Norte is the recipient of the Ben Reitman Award from San Diego State University for Peeping Tom Tom Girl, a wonderful collection of poetry and prose. Her poems are featured on MTA buses in the Out of Your Window project, and they were recently selected among the 10 best transit poems in the world by The Atlantic. She is a bus writer, you'll hear about that, and she continues to document life in Los Angeles in words and through photography via public transportation. And Michael Tolkien, the author of four novels, The Player, Among the Dead, Under Radar, and The Return of the Player. Michael won the Writers Guild of America Award for his screenplay for The Player and has also directed the movies The Rapture and The New Age. So I turn it over to David, take it away, and please enjoy the evening tonight. Thank you.
Thanks. So as Louise said, we're going to start with a series of small, three-minute readings from the various people on the panel, just to give you a taste of what they're doing, and then we're going to have a conversation amongst the six of us, and then we're going to turn it over to you guys for some questions in keeping with sort of the idea of being a writer in Los Angeles. And I do consider, you know, I have this very wide definition of writing, in meaning that if it involves words on paper in any way, then you're a writer. But in keeping with a wide definition, or my sense of writing in Los Angeles as an act of coloring outside the lines, we're going to throw that Pacific Standard Time temporal frame out the window so we can talk about, you know, work between 1945 and 1980, or between 1985 and, you know, 1990, or even up to the present. So we'll sort of see where this conversation goes. Hopefully it will become a kind of group endeavor rather than, will become a collective mind, a hive mind, rather than just a series of individual minds. But we'll see how that goes. I'm just going to kind of take the path of least resistance and start with Bernard, and we'll kind of slide around this little semi-horseshoe shape and read, and then we'll jump in. So, Bernard?
Great. Welcome, everyone. I think the only thing you need to know in the way of setup about this is that I am a native of Los Angeles, and I went to LeConte Junior High School on Bronson Avenue, and this is about that period of time. The Santa Ana wind blew relentlessly the night of Debbie Coburn's party, careening down the slopes of the Hollywood Hills, shaking the road signs and stoplights in its path. As I walked down Beechwood Avenue, trees thrashed, surrendered their leaves, and carob pods bombarded the pavement. The sky was a deep but luminous blue, the air hot, abrasive, electric. I had to squint in order to check the number of the Coburns' apartment, a three-story building with glitter embedded in its stucco walls. From down the hall, I could hear the plaintive strains of little Anthony's "I Think I'm Going Out of My Head." Debbie answered the door, bedecked in a dress of polka dots and stripes. "Op art," she proclaimed, turning in a circle. Reflections from the swimming pool in the courtyard, its surface ruffled by wind, shuddered over the ceiling and walls. A dozen of my classmates were seated on the sofa or huddled together in corners, their whispers full of excited imminence, their bodies barely discernible in the dim light. Drapes flanking the sliding glass doors bowed out with every gust of wind, and it seemed that the room might lurch from its foundations and sail with its cargo of silhouettes into the hot October night. Grady was the last to arrive. He tossed a six-pack of beer into Debbie's arms, barreled toward me, and slapped my back. His hair was slicked back with Vitalis, lacquered furrows left by the comb. The wind hadn't shifted a single hair. "You ready?" he asked, leering into the darkened room. "You bet," I lied. Once the beers had been passed around, Debbie provoked everyone's attention by flicking on the overhead light. "Okay," she called, "find a partner." This was the blunt command of a hostess determined to have her guests aroused in an orderly fashion. Everyone blinked, shuffled about, and grabbed a member of the opposite sex. Sheila Garabedian landed beside me, entirely at random, though I wanted to believe she was driven by passion. Her timid smile giving way to plain fear as the light went out. Nothing for a moment but the heave of the wind and the distant banter of dogs. I caught a whiff of Sheila's perfume, as tangy and sweet as Hawaiian punch. I probed her face with my own, grazing the small scallop of an ear, a velvety temple, and though Sheila's trembling made me want to stop, I persisted with my mission until I found her lips, as tightly sealed as a private letter. I held my mouth over hers and gathered her shoulders closer, resigned to the possibility that, no matter how long we stood there, Sheila was too scared to kiss me back. Still, she exhaled through her nose, and I listened to the squeak of every breath as though it were a sigh of pleasure. Diving within myself, I monitored my heartbeat and respiration, trying to will stimulation into being. And all the while an image intruded, an image of Grady erupting from our pool, rivulets of water sliding down his chest. "Change," shouted Debbie, switching on the light. Sheila thanked me, pulled away, and continued her routine of gracious terror with every boy throughout the evening. It didn't matter whom I held, Margaret Sims, Betty Vernon, Elizabeth Lee, my experiment was a failure. I continued to picture Grady's wet chest, and Debbie would bellow, "Change," with such fervor. It could have been my own voice, my own incessant reprimand.
Linnell?
I'm going to read part of an essay. I know Maricela and I were having a little conversation on Facebook about, what do we read? What do we read about L.A.? L.A.'s so big. How do you contain L.A.? And I too, am a native, so I'm going to read a piece from an essay, part of a piece from an essay I wrote about being a native. Okay. I've been told it must have been strange to grow up here. Strange, they say, because there are no seasons, or because there is no center, or it's not a real city. But now I read between the lines and think, strange, because to live here and successfully acclimate, people often throw off many layers of convention. Once they relieve themselves of the weight of abstract commitments and expectations, they are suddenly liberated to wander away from a more recognizable and responsible adult self. That gauntlet thrown down to normal is what kicks up resentment, challenges a life that doesn't ask questions or stretch out to explore. I often tell people that Los Angeles makes no sense if you talk about it out loud. The land of slow float car chases and girls with mercurial comb hair. So my LA exists in my mind in fragments, a conflation of time, space, and reality. It involves things that can't be put on postcards or projected on widescreens. I'm uncertain when I first realized that my existence here was so far different from how the outside world characterized it. But I began collecting, honing my own defining details way back, as if I knew I'd need to. Back when a 30-minute drive could throw you out into the sticks under a spill of stars, smelling eucalyptus and mustard. It was rustic, a term I equated with a sudden presence of coyotes and skunks, or the slapdash souvenirs of the journey decor found within the homes of canyon dwellers, or simply the barefoot meander. Rustic, I later came to understand, was a polite euphemism used by decorum-bound Easterners and Southerners to describe the haphazard existence we had jerry-rigged for ourselves. Rustic was this desert marked by summer days with blade-sharp heat that would suddenly soften the ocean breeze running in for a rescue. The reward on days like this was the vast glittering canyon view at the very moment when the hills unexpectedly stepped aside in the turn of the road. But I know those bits and pieces have sunk quick and deep into my consciousness. I live in this city with a healthy mixture of infatuation and infuriation. It's a place where the pattern of life can be disturbed just as easily by a location shoot shutting off several crucial city blocks at rush hour as by a riot long put on simmer, now coming to a boil. I sometimes marvel at how easily we learn to fall into place, to adjust to what at first looks or feels absurd by assigning some idea or out-of-air explanation for what many would find utterly inexplicable. Not long after 1992's much-euphemized insurrection, riot, revolt, response, or my favorite, unpleasantries, I was moderating a Sunday afternoon program at the downtown library, right here on the stage, a respected jazz musician's oral history of the dapper days of Central Avenue and the evolution of West Coast style. Everything was in place, the auditorium to capacity, the sound system piping in jazz sides of the era. Suddenly, moments before our microphones went live, the woman who had organized the program darted out from the wings, placing a sheet of paper into my hands. On it were instructions to give to the assembled guests that the gunshots, tire screeches, and explosions they might hear outside were not another riot, just high-tech FX for a new film starring Harvey Keitel and Robert De Niro. Nobody would be alarmed, and nobody was. Well-versed Well-versed, whatever else was erupting around us, we simply pressed forward, as so many of us already had long ago. That's just it. I grew up in a place of new beginnings, the place where people start from scratch. I grew up hearing about the road here, the whys here, and ultimately the frustrations and ruin of here. Too tall in order for even paradise. What happens when the possibilities run out? And what if, like me, you are already here? It's an existence that constantly sets up interior conflict, laid out black and white on the page. Los Angeles is both all that is real and all that is not. It builds it up and tears it down. It raises expectations and strikes them as efficiently as a set. And though you want to protect what stands before you, fragile as it is, you know it wasn't meant to last. It's fleeting and temporary. The glue, anticipation, and memory.
Michael?
This is from my new book, so this is actually world debut. And the book is complete science fiction. It's completely set in L.A., so what I'm reading is the only part of the book that's not about L.A. Because for some I couldn't find anything that would reduce it to 3 minutes, that I could get down to 3 minutes that was self-contained. All you need to know in this is when the narrator is a biker named Red Wings, and you can go home and look at what Red Wings means and why a biker would call himself Red Wings. The reference is to Shannon Squire. Shannon Squire is a resurrected pop star who has the world's most famous tattoo, and her tattoo was done and signed by a Russian tattoo artist named Smersh. Smersh is a reference to From Russia with Love, Smersh Spionim, Death to Spies. Red Wings Smersh, and Red Wings has a Smersh tattoo, and this is the story of how he got it. Red Wings kept a journal of his adventures on that trip, and by what would have been called a miracle if anyone still believed in God, the 10-page journal printed for circulation among the members of his club survived because he'd given it to his rehab doctor, you don't need to know, who left it with Red Wings before disappearing into the void of NK3, also you don't need to know. This is the story of how I got my Smersh tat, how I wrote to Vladimir Smersh Sorokin in Moscow with the help of Beria, a Russian brother from the Moscow chapter, who I met at the funeral of the treasurer of the San Rafael CA chapter, may he ride free forever, who translated my request. I sent the word that I very much admired the Smersh tattoo he had performed on the back of the singer Shannon Squire, and I so admired the craftsmanship and the meaning of Death Despise that if it were at all possible that I could come to Moscow and have him tattoo nothing but that word, his name, across my shoulders, I would pay what he asked. Smersh sent back an email not too long after I sent mine, also translated by Brother Beria, and therefore he could tell me, you come, I do, 500 euros. I thought he meant dollar sign instead of euro sign, but he preferred the euro sign because it was worth more. It's only money. Thus began my adventure of first acquiring a United States passport, which was, of course, made difficult because of affiliation with a well-known 1% motorcycle club, which is not a gang. As we say, this is not a criminal organization. This is an organization with some criminals in it. And that's a distinction I was able to make somehow with the TSA to get my passport. Actually, there was someone who you could say was a friend of ours in the TSA, and it was somehow taken care of by her. Then it was off by Delta Airways to Amsterdam, Holland, where I was met at the airport by a dozen brothers who had also brought a Harley Sportster for me, which normally I make fun of as a bike for women, although it's a fine bike, as my ride proved. But I was proud to join them on a great run across the flatland of Holland and then to the clubhouse in Old Amsterdam. What a trippy place. Legal hash. Well, time could not be wasted, and after we partied in Amsterdam, three of my Dutch brothers joined me on a trip from Amsterdam to Moscow, which took but 3 days. It blew my mind that the ride from Amsterdam to Warsaw took a total of 12 hours of actual riding time, which we did in a day and a half. 12 hours! I can say that I finally understand the Blitzkrieg. Europe is large on the map and small on the ground. And then another few days of easy riding to Moscow through Belarus, where I could just imagine the partisans in the forest if I just squinted my eyes. Think of it. So close the distances between these famous cities and places, and yet how many years did it take the Russians to defeat the Germans and get from point A in Moscow to point B in Berlin? I salute the soldiers on both sides of that mighty conflict. Mighty Mother Russia, I wish I had time to visit what had been Stalingrad to see where the epic battle took place, but I was there to get my tattoo. Smersh Sorokin could not have been a more regular, decent guy, which was not a surprise because in my experience, the real true artists, with some exceptions, hello, Bono, you pretentious motherfucker, that I have met have been easy to talk to and not just about themselves. Do you hear me, Bono? Now, Vladimir, that man did not drink, not ever, nor take any drugs, because he wanted a steady hand and nothing fuzzy ever between his inspiration and his amazing touch. He also was a man not to gossip, and when I asked him about Shannon Squire, he told me gently that just as he would never talk about me to anyone, he would not talk about her, a true Russian gentleman. I was surprised to see that he used the same inks as my tattoo artist in San Bernardino, CA uses, but I don't know why it should have surprised me. This truly is one world.
Maricela.
Thank you. Thank you, Louise, for inviting me to the table. With all due respect to Joan Didion, I like to sit next to someone I don't know and may never see again. Better than I like sitting behind the wheel of a car, most likely alone. Los Angeles doesn't need another driver out on the streets, and call me superstitious, but I learned how to drive in a 1971 Pinto in the Biba-lipped T-Rex meets Al Green teenage summer of 1972. I asked myself, just how would I maneuver gear shifts, gas pedals, while adjusting seam stockings and rear views of Whittier Boulevard as a miniature pine tree air freshener sways back and forth in sleep-inducing arcs? Why have me behind the wheel when, through a bus window darkly, I am able to take poetic leaps and transport myself through the language of street corners, memory, imagination, and dreams of East LA days and Fellini nights. I still cross that bridge that links Whittier Boulevard to downtown Los Angeles. It is probably one of my favorite views of the city, and judging from the Blade Runner-esque black makeup I am wearing, I am on my way to meet my chums at Clifton's on 7th and Broadway, before we work our way through another gallery party. This is 1984, back when artists could still afford the cheap rents around Rose and Traction. And it was just like that scene out of La Dolce Vita, where partygoers, us, held candelabra as we made our way through stairwells up to rooftops to get another view of this city. Back then, there was never any question about how and when I would be getting home. These days, I make sure to take that last sip before another unhappy hour comes to a close. Me, I'm still cruising the boulevard. There's a makeshift taqueria sandwiched between an eye clinic and a notary public on Whittier Boulevard, where families gather nightly to watch El Privilegio de Amar and Velo de Novia on a small TV set sitting on the hood of the owner's pickup truck. On several occasions, I've gotten off the bus to enjoy a couple of tacos and watch another long-suffering telenovela heroine weep through her waterproof mascara. The kids are all doing their homework, and I stand at the corner of Whittier and Lorena just to catch a glimpse of the downtown skyline. There is a comfort in knowing that the green sign on that skyscraper to the left brings back memories to East Angelinos. I like to think there's a kid riding on a bus somewhere who also thinks of it as his own Emerald City. Maybe he or she will be moved to pick up a pen and someday write a poem.
Joyce. Joyce is going to go up to the podium and we have some audio visual or some visual.
Right on. I'm concerned that it's hard to see and impossible to read. This is a story. I started a series of books with a partner called Tits and Clits in 1972, and the idea was that we had seen underground comics. There were no women's, well, there was only one or two women's underground comics at the time, and we felt that we had something to say about the incredible violence against women in 1972. So we started Tits and Clits, thinking of getting even with men, but deciding that it was, that wasn't our way. We weren't in a revenge mode. And so we started looking at, well, Playboy and all these other magazines are showing women from a man's point of view. And we decided to show women's sexuality from a women's point of view. So we brought out menstrual pads, menstrual blood, just all kinds of things. things that were very imaginative and really offended a lot of people. People were not accustomed to thinking of women and sex from a woman's point of view. And women were always worried about birth control. We have a different set of concerns than the men do. Pre-Viagra days, of course. And so we did this series of comics, and after the first one or two were done, we nearly got arrested for pornography. And I am not able to judge what is pornography, but one of the conditions of pornography, one of the definitions of pornography is to encourage prurient interest. What is that phrase? To bring about prurient thoughts in the reader. And as a judge said of somebody else's underground comic, this is too disgusting to have prurient, how do you say that word anyway? Prurient interest. It's too disgusting. And actually, it was true. We were not trying to arouse anybody. We were just trying to tell it like it was. And this, in turn, aroused a lot of people, but we didn't know it. And so I spent a year not knowing if I was going to get arrested for doing this. It's a long story. This is the story about it. I did it for a book that was not in my Tits and Clits series. And this just shows some of the artwork. I'm supposed to read this to you, but frankly, I can't even read it from here. So you can see the artwork. We were worried about getting arrested. We went to the ACLU. The ACLU gave us a certain amount of advice, but they also told us that in order to prosecute their case on free speech grounds, that they would not be necessarily in our interest, so we needed our own lawyers. And fortunately, some lawyers magically appeared and did this for us. We didn't have a dime. I was a bail bondsman at the time and with a state license. Go figure. You work your way through college the way you get through college. And so I was worried about losing my California state license if I got arrested for a felony. And my friend was worried about losing her two daughters to her ex-husband if she was arrested for a felony. So we had plenty of worries. And this is the story of that near arrest. Some people, actually, the bookstore owners who were selling our comics were arrested. And they did not get, the investigating officer bought the last issue of Tits and Clits for the investigation. So when they came back to arrest them, this is all in the small town of Laguna Beach, when they came back to arrest them, there was no evidence. So they grabbed all the other comic books, but they didn't get us. We were writing, publishing, selling, and three things in Laguna Beach, and it was a very easy arrest for the district attorney if they could catch the bookseller, then they could get the publisher, which was us, and then they could get the writers, which was us. And so it was kind of a jewel of an arrest if they could do it, but they blew it by buying that last copy. Anyway, for a year I worried about white cars, and I worried because my son was about 15 and he was doing a certain amount of low-quality drugs, and he would leave them around the house, and I said, look, you know, there they are on the coffee table, and if somebody comes to the door, they can see in the window, and there I go. You know, you want to lose your mother to jail? Just, and you too, by the way, Bubby. So, anyway, yeah, this is the last two panels here. The final panel, 8, is where I'm talking to my son about getting real. And he just thought I was full of baloney. So anyway, this is the story. It shows a little bit of my artwork, but my artwork has moved on. And this was about middle of where I was learning to draw, so things are different now. The Tits and Clits series ended in 1987, but the fear of being arrested was my personal censorship. I could never be so imaginative and think of all these crazy women things that we were thinking of because I now had somebody looking over my shoulder every time I held a pen. It was an extreme lesson in how to cut off your own fingers. Censorship, we have many arguments against censorship, but for the actual artist, it just undoes you, unless you like going to jail. And since I'd been a bail bondsman, I'd seen the number of inside jails, and I really didn't care to try it myself. So that's it. Thank you. Oh, yes. One more thing. I do actually have a Los Angeles connection. My parents died in South Los Angeles in 1994, and a few years later I started writing their story of the downward spiral and their deaths, and my dad had a great sense of humor. So that is my current book, Special Exits, which has got nothing to do with Tits and Clits, and it is on the market now if anybody's interested. But I am born and raised in Los Angeles several generations, and so I guess that's why I was invited here. Thank you, everyone.
All I can say is I'm glad those days are behind us and there is no war on women's sexuality or contraception.
Nothing more to write about.
No. It's ancient history. So, so that's the work. I got to say, this is awesome. I'm totally psyched. And I actually would almost just want to sit here and listen to these people read some more. But we have a mandate to talk, so we'll do that. And what I would like to do is just sort of throw out a general question first and then hopefully get more specific. But the general question is, what, if anything, is it about Los Angeles? I mean, in terms of how the city, I mean, obviously for those of you who grew up here, it's had an influence in some way. But in terms of doing work here, in terms of feeling freedom or lack of freedom, feeling engaged or marginalized, feeling like you're operating in conjunction with something or in opposition to something, what is it about Los Angeles? Does anyone, Michael, do you want to start?
I think things are beginning to change a little bit, but being a novelist in L.A. is a certain kind of internal exile nationally. There's no literary mafia here the way there are in New York. You know, the New York Review of Books takes care of its writers, N plus One takes care of its writers and champions them and supports them and criticizes the pricks from the other circles and sets up circuits that protect each other, and we don't have that here. I mean, I think the LA Review of Books, which is just starting, I've been to gatherings with more gatherings with writers and other writers in LA in the last couple of years than I have in the last 25, which is a healthy sign. Even things like this, you know, there's so I think that's changing, but we're still bound by validation from the East. And I think that L.A. writing is not East Coast writing. I think that's cruder. I don't think the concerns are at all the same. I mean, my new book is science fiction, and it's a really harsh book. It's not like anything I've written, and it's all about L.A. And in trying to do something about L.A., I think you take on a city, as you're describing, which is not like the East.
Anyone else want to jump in? I can call on you.
I want to say that when you're born and raised in Los Angeles, you don't have anything else to compare to.
Right.
So it's hard to answer your question.
Well, it grows, right. It grows out of your experience.
It is. I mean, to answer that question is a little bit like asking birds to talk about the trees they live in or something, because you do take it for granted. Right. And I think if you are born a writer or somebody in the arts, wherever you live is a source of astonishment and provide you with material. I mean, I've always felt that there's a sense of anonymity in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. because it's kind of out of the way, and people are looking to often to other centers, which is both a blessing in a sense because you can kind of start from scratch and you don't feel that people are looking over your shoulder. On the other hand, there is a kind of double isolation, and it is odd to be a writer in Los Angeles because people instantly ask you if you're writing screenplays.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So you're kind of an exile from the world of Hollywood and from the sort of literary center of supposedly of the East Coast. But there are two sides to the same coin. There's something great about it and also something one has to sort of work against a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's like there's that push and pull. I mean, you know, my word of the day, my word of most days is tension. So there is that tension between sort of, you know, that freedom it gives you, right? And also the sort of marginalization in some ways. You're always just simply the act of being a writer of poetry or prose or literary writer in Los Angeles marks you as an outsider, right, in some ways.
And try not driving.
And try not driving. I want to ask you about that. In fact, let's talk about that.
Oh, yeah. I did want to say something about this because as you were talking, I was thinking two things. One, being a native, I didn't think about it until I moved away and I was living in San Francisco for a while. And I found myself defending LA all the time, of course. And I thought, we like it up here. We don't talk bad about you. Why are you talking? But that was the first time I realized was living away from LA, was trying to figure out, well, how do I write about it when I lived? And that's when I really actually began writing about the city. But the other piece of that I was thinking about as you were talking, I have also found as a journalist, if you're writing about Los Angeles and you're trying to sell a piece about Los Angeles to a publication on the East Coast, they may say, if you're not writing about one of these different issues that they consider to be an LA issue or an LA theme, they'll say, oh, we don't want that. If it confirms what they know, they like it. Right. But if it takes them a different place, like, oh, no. And there was one piece I was working on about identity and race here and intersections. And I remember getting back a critique was, oh, no, that's too coastal. You know, I'm like going, what does that mean? But it was like they didn't know what to do with it. So that's the other thing I find that I'm explaining this place that not a lot of people will understand still.
Right. Or, you know, a friend of mine who wrote a novel, turned it into a New York editor, and parts of it took place in the hills, and the editor said, LA is just flat.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
Well, one of the things about working in Los Angeles is that you don't have a great burden of all these rules. I mean, if you're living in New York, you've got a lot of parties you go to and you talk to, you're in the groove. But in Los Angeles, part of being a Los Angeles writer, I would think, it certainly is if you live in Laguna Beach, where I live, is that you don't have any peers around you, so you have to think the whole thing out by yourself and you don't get any advice and you just go with it. And this, I think that that can give you a good basis for working it out and being true to yourself and doing some very interesting things because you're not following anybody else's rules.
Is that true? I mean, is that also true in the sense, I mean, you're sort of an outsider three times over in the way of...
Three times over, right. And I never even realized it because I didn't call myself a writer for one thing. And I haven't lived in Los Angeles for years, but I am born and raised here, so I have a Los Angeles mentality for what that's worth.
But I'm curious about, you know, in the 70s, you were saying you started Tits and Clits comics as a reaction to the misogyny of underground comics, right? Wasn't it, which is a really sort of fundamental kind of subtext to late 60s, early 70s liberation politics, right? What did Stokely Carmichael say? The only position for a woman in the movement is prone, right? So you're operating against that as a construct. You're operating in underground comics, which is outside in its own way also.
Exactly. And plus, I had no education in being a feminist. I had gone to college, but I had taken a degree in classical languages, which is the farthest thing from feminism. And had been reading Ms. Magazine a bit, but Ms. didn't want to have anything to do with us because we were too weird. And so we did our own thing. But three times over is true.
Right. Marcel.
Punk rock, I love it. It is. I'm sorry.
I was going to ask you about the bus riders, because that's another form of, you know, of in a way, of inside outside. It depends on how we look at the city, right? The city is perceived as an automotive city, as that Didion idea, right? A large part of life in Los Angeles is sitting alone in a car driving through neighborhoods that all look alike. But there's this whole other, I don't want to call it a subculture, because it is actually, I think, in a way, a kind of hidden dominant culture in a certain sense. But I wonder if you can talk about that, and also about the writing from that point of view. I mean, again, sort of identifying your work with not just a city that's on the outside, but a side of the city that is often
interior
seen
city.
That way. Yeah.
Well, it's just, I can't not do it. And as horrible as it is some days, I look forward to it every day. And I've been doing a lot of photography lately, a lot more. Linnell and I are planning our next photo trip, our first photo trip together. But there's a bus stop, my second bus stop of the day. From where I live to where I work, it's an hour and a half. It's sometimes 2 hours. So I might as well be going to Tijuana or to San Diego or somewhere, but I'm going to Wilshire and Fairfax. But it's the wait in between each bus. And at this particular bus stop, there's these beautiful agave plants against this very Frida cobalt blue brick wall. And every day I find something that sometimes I'd rather not find. Today I found a woman's camisole just hanging on the one of the.
I saw that one this morning.
And I thought, somebody's been following me and they're doing this on purpose. They're gaslighting me. They're going to drive me nuts because they leave these beautiful things. So sometimes I can't write about them and I have to just photograph them instead. So I think for me, I'm kind of making that shift right now of doing more visual work than I am actually writing. Did I even answer your question? I know I didn't.
No, but
let me go
okay.
back to about even getting on the bus. There's a guy clipping his nails to my left. And I'm thinking, really, this is where you're going to do your manscaping? Like, maybe it's me maybe that's okay to do. Everyone's on the phone now. I'm hearing everybody's very personal conversations that I'd rather not hear. So maybe clipping your nails, it's not such a big deal anymore. I don't know. But the things, I can't make them up, Dave. I'm telling you that I...
No, I know. I mean, I think that's the most... I mean, in that
Who
sense...
Who else doesn't drive? DJ Waldy, I found out,
I know,
does not drive
drove,
a car.
Right?
He's never driven.
And
why
Richard Rayner also does not drive.
I did a talk with Richard and DJ and myself.
It was the non-driving writers coalition?
It was. I'm now in that club. There's three members now. But we were at David Kippen's Libros Schmibros at the Hammer. And somebody asked him, like, where does he live? Like, in Downey or something? No, he lives past Lakewood.
Waldy lives in Lakewood,
right,
yeah.
Lakewood,
yeah.
Right.
That's like 3 days, you think. If you get on a local, it's the wayward bus. It really, you don't know where. And the thing is, if you have a notebook, if you have a pen, just go. And not everything, let me tell you, that comes out in that notebook ever makes it in here. But I just feel like I have to keep writing it down.
Now, interested.
It'll go somewhere.
I hope so. Yeah.
I'm interested in sort of ways that things develop or how people became writers. I mean, Bernard, you started out as a visual artist, right, at CalArts.
Right. Well, I started, this is kind of a sad admission, but I started off as a conceptual artist.
Oh, okay.
I went to CalArts.
That means you just sat around and thought about things. Imagine the clouds helping.
I was paralyzed and couldn't do anything. But, it was I actually went to CalArts right after the schools opened, and it was initially Walt Disney's dream, in a sense, as a farm from which to cultivate animators. But it, after his death, became it sort of held the promise of a new avant-garde school in America, a new Bauhaus, and avant-garde art really predominated the whole institution, and conceptual art was all the rage in the 1970s. So for me, it seems like an odd step to go from the visual arts to writing, although one of the great writers, Flannery O'Connor, once said that the sense of sight, and especially listening to Marisela talk about, you know, the camisole on the agave, that is a really crucial sense for a writer. And also going from conceptual art, which was largely text-based, to writing seemed much more logical to me at the time than it did to other people. It seemed like I was really switching gears. But even the description of the stucco apartment house that I just read was informed a lot by a book by Ed Ruscha that was a kind of document of stucco apartment buildings along Fountain Avenue, I believe. Mm. So it all intermingles and hopefully adds up right. to something, even when it seems in the process that you're just recording odds and ends.
Yeah. Michael, is that your experience between sort of novel writing and movie work? I mean, you've written films, directed films, as well as the novels. Sometimes they relate, a couple of novels about Hollywood, a couple not, some adaptations of your own or adapting the player. But can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, it's interesting. This is my... The frustration... I'll start over. I adapted one. I've written four novels. I adapted one.
Right.
The other three, I didn't. So there was some interest, but I wasn't interested in selling them. And there wasn't a review in the world after the first book, anywhere in the world, that didn't assume that what I was writing was a treatment for a movie that they turned out not to feel was a particularly good movie.
In terms of all the subsequent books,
from Among the Dead, Under Radar, and The Return of the Player. Now, The Return of the Player, I was obviously leading with my chin because that sounds like it's supposed to be a movie. And I wouldn't have minded it being a movie, but it was not what it was intended to be. And, when I read Atonement, when he's describing the guy, who's on the retreat, and there's a particular way he described the green coat. And I thought, you are just set dressing right now. This is absolutely a treatment for a movie. You're writing a movie. You have it. You want to get into the big bucks. You're being really smart. You know what sells. This is going to be a movie. It's going to go for the Oscars. And you are now describing a film. But nobody said, you know, McEwan used to be a really great novelist, but then as soon as he started writing treatments, you could feel the influence of the arc of the movie coming in, and you could feel that he was, you know, the floodwater is filling the subway, which is not what the kind of imagery he used to have. Nobody accuses John Grisham of... nobody reads John Grisham reviews, even crap like John Grisham. And is this going to be recorded? Yeah, crap like John Grisham.
I believe it's... And I believe the video will be on the internet.
Crap like John Grisham. I just want to make it really clear. Crap like John Grisham. And nobody... No one reviews... what I was saying, and says, but this is like, why bother with the book? Just wait until the fucking movie comes out. But nobody says that. Meanwhile, one little guy over here in L.A., but in L.A., any writer who has written for the movies is immediately bracketed. And it's frustrating.
No, sure, but I mean, I also think it's interesting. Like, if you look at a writer like, let's say, Nathaniel West, one of my favorites, who came out here to write for the movies, you can see, and I don't think it's a bad thing, but you can see, I think, the direct influence of his movie work on his fiction writing. If you look at Miss Lonely Hearts, the great lost American novel, it's a kind of symbolist, modernist novel. It follows, but when you jump to Day of the Locust, it's much more kind of... three-act structure in a certain sense, and the book that he was going to write when he died, the outline of the book is for a kind of hybrid of the two, a certain, like a Hollywood newspaper book. So I'm just thinking, I mean, I wonder about that only to open up that question because we're always defined by Hollywood. I agree with you. I mean, as a book review, when I was a book review editor, I couldn't tell you the amount of publicity calls I would get in a week from publicists saying, this is a perfect book for you, and it would be, you know, some Hollywood superstar autobio or whatever it was that we were totally not, anyone who had read the section would know we weren't particularly interested in, but, you know, whatever. The question, and maybe it's for all of us, is that the thing we're playing against? Is that in anyone's mind? I mean, I tend to write with it not in my mind, except I always know it's there.
Well, I think... there's a larger question, which is to what degree have the movies colonized, or to what degree did they
colonized literature, mm-hmm. and to what degree did literature then have to find strategies to not be the movies? And, you know, I mean, before the movies, books were this thick, and now they're this thick, except when they get to be this thick, like, you know, the fantasy books. And I think what's interesting, actually, sort of it's a sidebar, but what's interesting is the way in which the 12-episode arc for the cable series has replaced what the novel used to be. And that's really where the novel is now.
Oh, that kind of big social novel, absolutely.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And HBO's doing the corrections.
HBO bought the complete works of William Faulkner. Whether they do anything with it or not remains to be seen. But, I mean, you know, I can't wait to see the Benji section of The Sound of the Fury.
You know, you were talking about Nathaniel West earlier, and Joan Didion, in one of her essays, talks about how the image of Hollywood burning, Hollywood Boulevard in particular, at the end of Day of the Locust, is, I think she says, Los Angeles's
deepest image of itself.
Yeah. I knew you could quote that.
Yeah. Anyway.
But I think that the movies and the film industry have not only influenced literature, but have kind of, to use Michael's words, sort of colonized the popular imagination in a sense. And it's very hard to know where one thing leaves off and another begins and what is influencing what. It's kind of a hall of mirrors in a sense. But.
Right. Does anyone else want to jump? I mean, it's interesting. I wasn't necessarily thinking we were going to go this way, but I'm interested in this question. I mean, is that something that you guys are aware of or thinking about? Are you writing against or not, or totally ignoring? Or?
Well, definitely as a journalist. I mean, especially for, like, television, that influences how people think about L.A. and the L.A., you know, that I'm trying to write about, which is, like, you know, the neighborhoods and what's happening, like, off on the edges. It's outside of the frame that we're forced to sort of look at. But I remember when the O.J. Simpson chase happened and the trial and all of that that followed it, and I had to write essays explaining it for the A section of the paper, and it was stressful, and I had to put off a trip that I had been planning on taking, and I was going to be going overseas, and I was really happy to be, like, away from all of that. And of course, the first place I go to sit and have coffee the next morning, somebody says, "Oh, where are you from?" And I said, "I'm from Los Angeles." "Oh, what about this J.O.? So I didn't travel this far for this. But he wanted to talk about that. And he wanted to talk about that L.A. and this perception. So he had questions about gangs and O.J. and the riots and all of that. So, yeah, as a journalist, you know, you're struggling against that, trying to, like, there's more stories here. There are more stories here than just those that
right.
television and movies are, you know, covering. And
or how they're covering.
Because, and how they're joining.
Because,
them.
Joyce, in Special Exits, which is the book about your parents dying, those sort of, some of those larger-than-life cultural events, the riots, for instance, factor into the story as part of the narrative because of, you know, your parents living in the neighborhood and what their experience was. The Northridge earthquake, a different kind of cataclysm, factors into the narrative because of what their experience mm-hmm. was during the...
Well, of course, my dad had experienced the 1965, what did you call it?
Unpleasantries?
Unpleasantries. The 1965 unpleasantries. So he knew exactly what to do during 1992. 82 years old, barely able to walk, going and opening the front door and saying, "Well, those are all along Figueroa because they're all kind of in a line and it's not the residential area, so we won't worry." And then they went without electricity for 44 hours.
Right, and that, I mean, it's a key part of the book. So that, you know, that what, so because what we're talking about here is interesting in this way that, you know, these big sort of events, let's say, or big picture images, Hollywood, the riots, earthquakes, etc., kind of define Los Angeles outside of Los Angeles. That's what people think about. How can you live there? But in fact, they are woven into the fabric of, I mean, if we live here, obviously they're woven into the fabric of life. If you're writing about what it's like actually to live here, they're woven into the fabric of the work. I guess the question I'm asking is, do you ever feel a tension in terms of the trying to make it real and three-dimensional in a way that expresses the experience of living here? And are you aware of the preconceptions that the outside world or audience or whatever we want to call it is potentially bringing to that, those experiences as well?
Well, I in all the books I've written, four, three set in L.A., of the previous novels, three set in L.A., and it was really important to me to treat L.A., to take L.A. for granted. You know, if the New Yorker short story can just say Park Avenue or Central Park or Grand Central Station without saying a large building in the middle of New York. I mean, you know,
I'd love to see them do that.
You know, or I mean, it's or you know, it's like you read Russian literature, you don't see Nevsky Prospect. You know what it is? I mean, you've been there, even if. So I always just say the street name or the area without any further qualification of it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's really important to me. I don't get into, I mean, unless it's important, unless the character's perceptions are important, I just use the word with all of the baggage that that it carries for me, mm-hmm. and I just leave it there.
Right. And then, yeah.
It seems that writers who pay attention to place do that. I mean, this is a strange association, but I'm thinking about Robert Lowell's poems and how he mentions street.
Great LA poet.
What's that?
A great LA poet.
But he talked about the East Coast where he grew up with the same kind of specificity. And I think anybody who's paying attention to writing is kind of trying to find the poetry in street names and what buildings are named and all the kind of all the stuff that's around you that's a given. I think every writer also, I mean, I know that when I was writing that scene about the makeout party, that I was really well aware that Joan Didion had written some of the definitive writing about the Santa Anas, but so has everyone written beautifully about love and about, you know, sexual identity. So I feel like as a writer, you're trying to revive things that you know have been written about before, at the same time look at them from a new perspective, same with, you know, aspects of geography or place.
Well, sure, and I think also there's that critical density, right? Because just because Didion's written about the Santa Anas or Chandler doesn't mean that the territory is now off limits to anyone else who wants to write about it. You can always come in and occupy that territory. That's part of the joy or the challenge of it, right?
And then like Lowell, you can write a great poem like For the Union Station Dead.
But you know, Dave...
A couple of people I knew would get that.
I don't even pay attention to it, right. You know, and it's like the city that I live in, the Spanish is not italicized.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. It's just there, you know. So,
yeah.
And this whole idea that the questions I get sometimes, because I'm a woman and because I'm a brown woman, is like, oh, you must be writing magical realism, like, you know, flying grandmas, and that's just not it.
Right. The bus is really an important magical realism terrain.
Magical reality, yeah, right? Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
You don't have to make it up.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's interesting because I think one of the things that, for me, marks LA writing, and in some ways marks all of you guys, is that it is, you know, the work kind of, the lines get blurred in the sense that, you know, you know, Bernard, you're writing fiction, nonfiction, long form, short form. Linnell, you're writing essays. You're a journalist. Michael, you're writing scripts and books. Marcella, prose, poetry, photographs. Joyce, you're merging images and text and kind of creating narrative in those ways. And it seems to just be sort of, you know, it seems to be completely organic. You know, the ideas take their own form. So I wonder if you guys can talk a little bit about that idea.
Well, I think Joyce actually hit on it when she said that you know, there isn't quite the weight of or burden of history in a sense. And Los Angeles, this is a huge generalization, but it seems to be a place where people by and large make it up as they go along because it, you know, people from all over come and try to fashion their version of the world. I mean, that's true with a lot of places. But, I think there is built into the newness of the city and the anonymity a willingness to experiment with form as well as content.
When I started, I didn't intend to be a journalist. I sort of backed into it, and I was really interested. I can't remember when I wasn't writing. You know, I was reading and then writing and reading and writing. But I think part of it was exactly that. It was this idea of trying to take a snapshot, like a written snapshot of what my life was here and whatever it was going to take to do that. So part of it, I think that's how I evolved into a journalist, because that required, I went out and talked to people and used their stories. It was a collage. So I started realizing, like, I'm doing collages. I really love this idea of being a reporter, but not in the, you know, fedora and, you know, in the thing in the hat, press pass in the hat band way, but the stories and, like, being able to kind of, you know, put those stories together in a collage way, using the devices of fiction, in terms of description and setting up the place, but really being able to root people in this place and with their real stories. So I think it started to evolve that was the way to do it. So, yeah.
Joyce, did you want to say?
Well, I'm just thinking that Los Angeles and its stories is probably not that different from New York or any other place and its stories. It's kind of how we take them. And those of us who are born and raised in Los Angeles, as I said before, we really don't know anything else. I lost my mother. My mother died when I was 11. And my dad married a very wonderful stepmother for me, and probably a wife for him, but I don't really know their relationship. they had an odd marriage. But
it's all in the book.
But as a result, my stepmother was always my friend, but she was never my mother. And so I had no mother from the time of 11 years old. And when at 30 or so I started doing Tits and Clits, I've talked to a lot of other cartoonists and other writers who said they never could have done it because they had a mother. And I think that not having a mother on my neck, well, everyone I know has got a very odd relationship, I mean, very stressful relationship with their mother. There are very few smooth, fine relationships with their mother. So I was out there on my own from a very young age and accustomed to making the decisions that you make when you're young. I was never a bad kid, especially. I just did stuff. But nothing.
You just did those crazy comics.
Well, I was 30 or so when I did the comics, so that I can't excuse that on child. But I think not. I think being able to say yes and not self-censor yourself is a very special gift, and I think I was given it wholeheartedly, you know, completely. You may have had to take it for yourselves by either divorcing your family or leaving your family, coming to. A lot of people who come to Los Angeles, they're very opinionated about what Los Angeles is, and I've heard it all too, like you, everybody else has. But the thing is that they're leaving someplace else to come here for some dream.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're not born here. I mean, when you're born here, you just don't have anything else. You're sitting here, and that's the way it is.
Right. It's like,
does that answer anything?
Yeah. It's like what Linnell said in her reading. What if, like me, you were already here? Yeah. Right. The city is only exotic, or it's what Waldy calls sacred ordinariness, which right. is my favorite phrase maybe of all time. Except for, what was the other one we were talking about? The hallucination phrase, which is now I've hallucinated out of my head. But sacred ordinariness, which is this idea that in this city, in some way, because of all of the overlays, only here would ordinary daily life, people riding the bus, people picking their kids up at school, people, you know, struggling at a job or figuring out how to make ends meet. Only would that would only be exotic here because we have such a kind of mythic overlay of what the city is, which in some ways, you know, all those myths have some grounding in reality, but they really have nothing to do with how 95% of the people in the city live. When I first moved here and I would go back east to visit, friends would say, so do you see a lot of celebrities? And I would say, they don't really live in my neighborhood, you know? So, but there is that kind of, that overlay of perception. Are you?
Well, you know, one of the places I teach is at Bennington College in Vermont. And it's a wonderful faculty, an incredible program. I am surprised, though, sometimes how people who were born in the East Coast impose very cliched ideas about, particularly about the lack of culture in Los Angeles. It's kind of shocking. I mean, otherwise, really smart people who don't otherwise buy into cliches very easily. The things that come out of their mouths are kind of astonishing. And I mean, I risk, I think, sometimes sounding like, you know, a booster for Los Angeles, but I do think it is so exciting. And the literary world, you know, the reading series like these, the art world is thriving. I mean, it's absolutely incredible what is happening here. And it's funny how a lot of people on the East Coast have not caught up in there's a provincialism, a blindness to the riches here that mm-hmm. it shocks me sometimes.
It makes their lives easier.
It does. I mean, the assumption is that the New York in particular sort of rules the world.
Right.
And it people do have certain, they have blinders on.
Sure.
In a sense. I this is kind of veering off track a little bit, but and it may be rumor, but I'd heard that Peter Sheldahl, the critic for the New Yorker, the art critic, who I lived in Los Angeles for a long time, was going to write an article, had been assigned to write an article for the New Yorker about how the focus of the art world was shifting to Los Angeles, and oddly, it never came out. I mean, you know, I don't think there's any conspiracy there, but it's just, it's interesting that someone who is such a power broker in the East Coast was going to talk about a shift in power, but it never appeared in the New Yorker anyway. Maybe it'll appear someplace else.
I thought
else.
It did. I thought I read it. I get the New Yorker. I thought I had read it. How come I'm imagining this?
I hope you're not.
It's that hallucination thing. But it's also interesting because, I mean, now I'll, you know, not that this entire conversation hasn't been one digression on top of another, but I'll add another one to the mix, which is that, you know, if you look at a lot of East Coast, or there's a whole category of East Coast writing about Southern California that critiques the architecture, right? You know, I mean, going back to West opens The Day of the Locust with a long riff critiquing the architecture. Truman Capote, when he came out here and wrote that essay, Hollywood, that Linnell turned me on to years ago with the great line, students at a school were interviewed, 50% of students, when asked to name the opposite of youth, named death. But more to the point, he critiques the architecture. Mailer critiques the architecture, and Superman comes to the supermarket, and it's all about how stupid the architecture is, right? Because people live in French chateaus or those fairy tale houses with the droopy roofs, or stone manors, or whatever it is they want to live in, or teepees, or you have restaurants that look like derby hats or dogs with pipes.
I missed that.
You missed, yeah. That's before my time, but nonetheless, to me, that's sort of an expression of kind of the democratic promise of the place in a certain sense. You want to live in a stone manor, and you have the resources. Who cares? Live in a stone manor. You want to live, in a yurt. You can live in a yurt, and there's something kind of great about that. And I think in some ways, that's what we're talking about in terms of the art and the writing too. Is if you want to write in this form or all of these forms together, you've got the opportunity to do so.
It's also such bullshit. The idea that there's the critique of the architecture of LA as though New York is like this ancient 5,000-year-old city that has just grown organically out of the mud, that the mud flats out in Brooklyn evolved into. It's all made up.
Sure.
Right. New Rochelle doesn't look any different than any other fancy suburb anywhere in the world.
Right. There's no such thing as an organic mansions. City, right?
What?
There's no such thing as an organic city. A city is created on right. So, yeah. All right, on that note, let's turn it over to some questions from you guys. There are microphones sort of passing through the room, so raise your hand and
I can see them better now.
Jump in.
I'm wondering why Los Angeles seems so tolerant and receptive to the flaky. Whether that's put in that category, perhaps the acceptance of Eastern religion. I'm wondering if it has to do with a search in some way for the non-self or alienation, all those categories. Los Angeles seems especially tolerant.
We're open to new feelings.
That was beautiful.
That was beautiful.
Yeah. We're going to do our new age thing now.
Do you mean flaky New Age or flaky like Kardashian reality show, that kind of LA?
I mean more
the non-self, searching for something other than yourself or existing other than...
That's America.
Yeah.
That's the American search. That's not the L.A. search. I don't think that's any... I mean, that's from Emerson to Huck Finn to...
Kerouac.
To East Coast writers coming here and slumming by writing a Hollywood novel that's awful. And there are dozens of those. What? Yeah. I mean, what, L.A. as the birth of noir style?
Non-self, alienation.
Right, that's right.
I don't know about non-self, but one would hope that all vibrant cities are receptive to flakes and strange ideas. I mean, that's kind of what makes living in a city a great experience, I think.
And I think it does sort of piggyback on what you were saying earlier about this idea that, like, the rules are different. There are no rules. We can kind of do... People come here to do things away from people who know them, you know, their families and that sort of thing. They don't have someone looking over their shoulder.
That's true. And live and let live, very strong.
Me too. Yeah, over there.
Hi. One of the themes that seems to run through some of the comments that you all, well, maybe not all made, but certainly Bernie and Linnell, is the weather in Los Angeles. And weather in other literatures plays a strong role in New England and in Russia, for instance. And I wondered if any of you would talk about the effect of weather on literature here.
Do you mean the weather we don't have?
But
we're on storm watch right now.
Right.
Storm watch.
I'm so glad you guys all came, despite the fact that we're on storm watch. It's true.
Brave.
No, it's a reaction to all of the seasons being the same, which Linnell.
There are four seasons for what is it? Fire, flood, earthquake, and drought.
Right. Exactly.
That's something that Didion talks about in a lot of her essays. The idea, I think, as she puts it, that the seasons go by relentlessly, numbingly bland, which she says is not true. But she talks about how the weather of Los Angeles is the weather of apocalypse because of the fires, because of the winds, because of the floods, and that if you think about it, that's a lot of weather conditions for any place to deal with. They're different, but she really equates, let's say, the way winter affects New Englanders with the way torrential rains affect people who live here, and it's a different kind of weather, but it has that same permeating effect, I think.
I think it's winters used to affect New Englanders. I don't know if they have winters the way they used to. I don't know. I think that's in retrospect, that's the weakest part of her of the discussion of LA is the weather. It's just basically talking about the weather. I mean, you know, it's like, what is it, the Mary McCarthy, the great essay on Macbeth, you know, so foul and fair a day I have not seen, and she says, he's like a Republican golfer, say, hey, nice weather we're having, how good weather. No, I mean, I think it's, the weather here is different than it is in other places, but there's no standard. Yeah. We're a temperate, more people live in the temperate, you know, I don't know, it's like, never mind.
I mean, I know, this last windstorm we had in that affected actually my neighborhood in Pasadena, Altadena, it was so extreme. And, you know, and all of us were all kind of, oh, yes,
with
Santa Ana's. Yeah, Santa Ana's, we've been through that. It's no big deal. But then when it sounded like a train running through, and that was real, I thought, okay, we have not seen an extreme. This was really extreme. And I was actually surprised at how unified my neighborhood was. It was reminded me of the other extreme, was the earthquake, the Northridge earthquake, where everybody banded together and got up really early in the morning and walked around and made sure that everybody was there. So it seems like when we have these really extreme things, then our behavior changes. and actually you get to know your neighbors a little bit more because otherwise you just kind of wave hello, you know. And but with the weather, that's where I really feel it, with this extreme heat, then that whole myth that, you know, this is earthquake weather, like it's hot and then cold and hot again and now we're going to have an earthquake. I grew up with that, you know, at school, you know, kids trying to scare kids trying to scare teachers, tell their mother, I don't want to go to school because there's going to be an earthquake. So.
But don't you think it's also part of, it's like an idea of community? Because that's the other thing that we tend to overlook, you know, that Los Angeles or whatever, Southern California, like everywhere else, I agree, it's like everywhere else in the sense that it's a series of communities. It's a city, mm-hmm. among other things, it's a city of neighborhoods, you know, I mean, distinct neighborhood that has a real neighborhood identity. I've lived in other neighborhoods that have different neighborhood identities. And we kind of tend to over... That's another thing. That's another piece of that ordinariness that gets overlooked in terms of these big statements. Sprawl, you know, speed and light, freeways, fast cars and convertibles. You know, there's all this other stuff going on below the surface.
Right, but I think the interesting thing about the neighborhoods in L.A. is that I think that the growth of really specific neighborhoods, and it's like every three blocks is another... Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's another sign.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the abstract end zone neighborhood or whatever.
Faircrest Heights.
But what's interesting is because the traffic got so slow,
yes.
people and traffic got slow and coffee and the espresso machine got imported. that's really it. I mean, I've got friends in Venice. I've got friends in New Hampshire. I see more often than I see friends in Venice,
right?
They're friends.
Yeah, yep.
But it's easier for me to go to New Hampshire and visit somebody. It's really easy for me to go to New Hampshire, fly to Boston, drive 3 hours, get off the road, go up Route 22, make the right, down the road. It's easier than going to somebody who lives on Rose, where I live. So what's happened is I think that where LA is heading, I think, is towards more and deeper neighborhoods and deeper neighborhood identifications.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
that's
totally
a process that's
that.
Really just begun in the last 15 years.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Mm. Other, we have one over here, sir.
Good evening. So I have two questions. One of them is for Marisela, and the other one is for everybody. Actually, or not for everybody, but the other question is just like, can the person who was not born in L.A. identify yourself?
I was also not born in L.A., but I'm not on
that. Ba-da-da-da-da.
And the other question for Marisela, 20 years ago you visited my high school class.
Which high school?
I was at Roosevelt High School, and we had a mini campus at East L.A. College. And you read a few poems, and then you also spoke a little bit about, I don't know, about writing and your life and all that. But I remember that you said that you had just gotten a driver's license. And I remember that you were wondering how the writing was going to change. And you were still a little unsure that you felt, you know, that
inspired.
You wanted to be driving.
Never
and all that. So I'm just curious, why did you, all these years, I've just assumed you're a driver now.
Oh, God, no.
So I was just going to ask, like, you know, what happened?
I think I need to, I told Gil Cedillo, I said, when undocumented workers get licenses, that's when I'm going to get my license. That's what I told him.
Bravo.
So we'll wait for that to happen. I think I should have one just in case. You know, I could rent a car and take my mom out, you know, instead of walking her to Astro, which is what I usually do when I take her out to lunch. So I think it's something I need to have. I don't know if it's going to change the writing. I wrote Peeping Tom Tom Girl, which is about East LA. I wrote it in Mexico on a beach in Puerto Vallarta, nursing my broken heart with my little typewriter that I would drag to the beach. I don't know if it's going to change it or not. I'll be able to go far. I'll go to Laguna, you know, which is, I used to house it out there and I loved it. And maybe I'll go to Venice, which still terrifies me. I'm so afraid of Venice. I just think, no, I'm serious. You guys are laughing. Huh? I'm scared to go. Because I just think I'm going to get shanked on the beach or something terrible is going to happen. So what happened? I don't go there. I know where not to go. I hear Grunk laughing, but I know where not to go. So I don't know if it'll change the work. I'll get to stay out late longer, which I'm missing my bus right now as we speak. So.
Hi, I'm just celebrating my 10th
anniversary in Los Angeles, and I love it every day.
Yay.
I'm originally from New York and many years in San Francisco, and one of the things that I notice about LA, my experience, especially compared to San Francisco, is that it's more competitive and very ambitious place. And a lot of what we do here does have impact on a national stage, and I just wonder how that influences any of your work, if you have that feeling as well.
It's strange. A friend of mine was out here recently visiting from London, and he specifically talked a great deal about how different it was from London and New York, where he had also lived, where he felt the level of competition was sort of deadly, in a sense, and how in Los Angeles he tended to meet people who were sort of more guilelessly curious about each other and about each other's art, and not quite, I mean, maybe this might have been his own perception, but not quite as ready to see where they were in comparison to each other on this, you know, kind of hierarchy of success. And I mean, this may be my own individual experience, but I tend to think that is the case. And I hope that although Los Angeles is becoming increasingly influential and there, you know, it's being looked at with a kind of scrutiny it hasn't before, that flakiness, that openness to flakiness will remain somewhat. So I haven't experienced that, really, what you're talking about.
Hi, I actually have two questions, or similar. Do you think that there's like a real LA in how you describe it to the world? And the second part to that question is, do you think there's a challenge describing LA to other Los Angelinos who feel that their LA is the real LA?
I mean, that's like asking, like, is your LA better than mine? I mean, who cares, really? I don't. I mean, sometimes when I read something and it's like they just... Okay, I'll give you an example. It has nothing to do with what you just asked me, but I'm going to give you this example. There's a movie picture book of the movie Psycho. In one of the scenes when Martin Balsam goes to the Bates Motel to talk to Norman, Norman is saying he's going to change the sheets because it gives him, I don't know, kind of a creepy smell, he says. And that already you're like... terrified because he said a creepy smell. Well, in this book, they say, I don't know, it gives it kind of a crazy smell. Like, did you not do your homework? Why did you mess up that line? It's just like when somebody's writing about the city and they, why did they go over there? Like, what are you talking about? That's not how it is. Do you see what I mean? That gets under my skin. But you're LA? Let's hear it. I don't think there's that. I don't know about my fellow panelists, the band. I don't know how the band feels about it.
Go ahead.
Well, it just seems to me that the act of writing in general, sort of trying to persuade someone, anyone else, that what you experience or what you perceive or are interested in writing about is the real story, in a sense, not one that necessarily takes precedence over anyone else's, mm-hmm. but that there's something nagging that seems like the truth that you want to get down in some way. So, I mean, that kind of confirms what you're talking about, but I don't think it's about having a view of the city that somehow trumps other views.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, for me, it's like something Michael just said. I mean, he said before about how hard it is to get from here to there and how that, you know, it's easier to get on a plane and see a friend. And I think about, for any of us who, you know, we've been here a long time, there used to be, you'd say, oh, I can be there in a half hour. So all of LA felt like yours, you know, and you could experience Santa Monica on the same day that you could also experience the Huntington Library. You could move around the city with more ease, and it became part of who you are, back to that collage. And now that's different, so it's, you have to plan. But I still like to think of, you know, all of LA is my LA, mm-hmm. and like you, I get upset if somebody gets something really simple wrong. And I was like, you could have just looked at a map, and you could have just checked online or something, but yeah.
It's like 80s hair in a movie about the 50s. That's like...
Yeah, but sometimes they get something wrong. There was a novel, I can't remember which one, which came out about 15 years ago. It was a non-Angelino writer writing about L.A., and he described a route that someone took to get basically, I think, from like Koreatown to Hollywood, which you could do it, you know, but nobody would. Nobody who lived in the city would, you know. So just by watching what that route was, you're like, all right, this guy, you know, he doesn't looked at a map and sort of said, oh, I'll take this boulevard to this boulevard.
The best novel about L.A.'s geography is Mildred Pierce.
Oh, yeah. Well, Mildred Pierce may be the best novel about L.A. in some way.
Yeah, but it is. But I mean, I because it's one of the great things in the book, getting from Glendale to Beverly Hills into Pasadena.
But there's a scene in the storm.
In the storm. But there's a scene in the book when she and, I forget the guy's name, go down to Laguna.
Monty.
But what's really great.
Name is Monty.
What's really great. What's really great is that it takes them in 1930, what?
39?
Earlier. So 37, 38. It takes them less time to get to Laguna then than it does now. They go down there for like a roadhouse for steak, and it's all orange groves. So it's just there's no freeway. But the roads are okay. They're on those big balloon tires. And it's like and Chandler, in one of the books, he just needs to burn off some steam. So he goes up the Pacific Coast Highway, makes a right turn at Oxnard, and comes back down, comes back down the valley the way, I don't know, I used to do a route on Coke, you know? I mean, it's like a...
This is going out on...
I'm going to work something out.
One more question.
First of all, thank you so much. I've been in Los Angeles over 20 years, all of my adult life, and am recently obsessed with literature and things of Los Angeles. I teach high school, so my question to you, which really builds on your most recent comment I wrote down, Mildred Pierce, is there any recommendations, in addition to your own work, that you have for helping young people to appreciate the communities, the variety of communities that exist in Los Angeles, especially, like, I teach in Santa Monica, and while people have a perception that it's a very affluent neighborhood, I have a lot of students who've never left Santa Monica, that all they know is that neighborhood, and really trying to expose them to all of Los Angeles. So any recommendations that I could take back to them as we continue our journey through the city?
The big blue bus goes to downtown LA. Catch the 10.
Take a bus.
I'm sorry, put it on.
Read everybody on this panel. That's a good start. His work is hard to find in print because he's never published a collection, but Luis Alfaro, I think, he writes brilliantly about growing up in the city, Pico Union. There's all kinds of stuff. What do you guys think?
Mona Simpson's My Hollywood might be great, and I also think, is it D.J. Waldie or J.D. Waldie?
D.J. Waldie.
His book, Holy Land it's about Lakewood. It's about a suburb, but I think...
And the L.A. Sections of Anywhere But Here, which is Mona Simpson's first novel, is brilliant. I mean, it seems like a weird demarcation, but it's brilliant on living on the wrong side of Wilshire in Beverly Hills, right? What it means to live south of Wilshire in Beverly Hills as opposed to north of Wilshire in Beverly Hills. And it's fascinating, as a social documentary.
What's that book she actually she teaches at Riverside, the book
Susan Strait.
It's great, the book about the mother who did take what? Yeah, that's a great, I mean, I would, that's a great book, great Southern California book.
What was it?
Susan Strait.
The title was
High Wire Moon.
Susan Strait, a really great LA book. Really great.
Can I add the John Retchie, The Miraculous, is it The Miraculous Day of Amalia Gomez?
Gomez, yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful book about perspective of Hollywood from someone who works here. Beautiful book.
And since we were talking about him before, Richard Rayner's book, L.A. Without a Map, which was one of the books I read about L.A. before I moved here, which is a novel. Richard Rayner is a British writer who lives in Venice, who doesn't drive. This is a novel about a character named Richard Rayner, who is a British writer who lives in Venice, who doesn't drive. it's terrific, and it's a lot. There's a lot of bus riding in it. So.
That's cool. He's a good guy.
Don't forget John Fonte.
Oh, John Fonte.
Right,
John
right.
Fonte Square, right outside. Yeah.
And there's
there.
A really good book that people don't, a lot of people don't know about, but John O'Hara's Hope of Heaven.
Oh, great book.
Yeah, isn't that great?
Great book.
It's a novella. It's like this. It's like a slice of, it's Westwood, the West Side, Beverly Hills, Hollywood. He just goes all over the place in this tiny little book. It's so beautiful.
Beautiful question.
Well, thank you guys. First of all, just thank you. This was
thank you
so
all. Wonderful
fun.
Panel.
Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.